Good morning and welcome to this May 3rd, 2017 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at KUCI.org. We are always available via podcast. I am your co-host, Marie Stone, and this is my favorite time of year. It is our annual KUCI Fund Drive. It is time for our listeners to give us a little love back. So we bring you, we have been on the air, I can't believe it, next April we will have been on the air. This show has been on the air for 20 years. I'm celebrating 10 years this year on the show, and so all of this time that we're giving you sort of an MFA program on the air. We're talking with Pulitzer Prize winning authors, Booker Prize winning authors, really renowned folks here who are giving you their best writing advice. They're telling you exactly how they got their books published, all about craft. And so this is kind of your free MFA program, our service to you. So in the spirit of that, we would love to have you, if you are a loyal listener, if you're a past guest, if you're an aspiring future guest, we'd love to hear from you and we'd love to get your support. So I am here all morning, and we're giving away some awesome gift certificates to some local indie bookstores. Even if you don't live in the area, all of these bookstores have online websites so you can order away in the convenience of your own home. Laguna Beach Books has donated, Lido has donated, as well as Mystery Inc., all $25 gift certificates with your $50 donation. And we've got some books. We've got both authors' books that we are interviewing this morning. So we will give away those as well with your donation. And $35 gets you a pretty cool t-shirt, pretty cool coffee mug, and a really neat, we're offering thumb drives this year, KUCI thumb drives. So anyway, give us a call, 949-824-5824. 949-UCI-KUCI, or you can always donate online. Just mention Writers on Writing when you do that at KUCI.org. So in addition to our fun drive, we're doing what we always do, which is welcome authors onto the show. I'm excited this morning to welcome Pam Jenoff. She is joining me now, and in the second half, I'll chat with short story writer Eric Puchner for his latest collection, Last Day on Earth. Pam Jenoff is the author of several novels of historical fiction, including the international bestseller, The Commandant's Girl. She holds a bachelor's degree in international affairs from George Washington University and a master's degree in history from Cambridge. She received her JD from the University of Pennsylvania. She is inspired by her experiences working at the Pentagon and also as a diplomat for the State Department handling Holocaust issues in Poland. If that weren't enough, in her spare time, she's also a law professor. Her latest novel is The Orphan's Tale. We have one and only one copy of it available this morning for your $50 pledge. And it is published by Mira Books. It's the subject of our chat this morning. Pam, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm so happy to have you. This was such a great book. So I'm going to let you take us into the novel, talk a little bit about the inspiration. I know you spent some time in Poland. I'd love to hear about that. But just kind of open this world up for us, this world of Astrid and Noah, and kind of tell us their story.
So Noah is a young Dutch girl. She's about 16, and she's been kicked out by her parents after becoming pregnant by a German soldier. This is during World War II. She's living above a rail station in Germany, which she's cleaning to earn her keep. And there she makes a horrific discovery. It's a boxcar of babies, the train of unknown children, and it is a train of children taken from their parents, too young to know their own names, and they are headed for a concentration camp. In a moment of fateful impulse, Noah rescues one of the babies, and she flees into the night. And she finds shelter with a German circus that has rescued Jews. The circus owner says she and the baby can stay, but in order to blend in, she's going to have to become part of the circus. And he decides that she should learn the aerialist act or the flying trapeze. And she learns this from Astrid, who's an older woman who's Jewish. I'd say older. She's about 40, but older than Noah. And she is to learn the flying trapeze from Astrid, who is none too happy to have Noah there. And so it's really a book about the friendship between these two women and whether they can save each other or whether their secrets will destroy them both.
I love it. She, I really like this juxtaposition of the Holocaust against the circus. You know, I think putting two disparate kind of, you know, disparate in your head ideas together is always very interesting. And the, kind of the connection of trains, you know, we think of circus trains and obviously the train imagery is conjured up during the Holocaust. So talk a little bit about that inspiration of, you know, whether it was these two very different textures being married in your mind that made this book come alive for you, or anything you have to say about that.
Well, really, it came from two true stories that I read in the Yad Vashem virtual archives, and one was a horrific account of a train of unknown children, and I took that image, and just the image, and I combined it with another true story that inspired me, which was a story of a German circus that had sheltered Jews. And so, you know, I didn't create the canvas of Circus Against War. That was very much in existence, but I agree with you that the juxtaposition is interesting. You have this notion of, you know, ordinary life and the circus and the things that went on against the horrors of the war. You have this idea of hiding sort of in plain sight as you're performing. And I think that the flying trapeze is powerful because there's almost this caged bird notion, right? They can fly, but they can only fly so far.
Right, right. It's funny. I heard an interview you did where you said you actually don't even like the circus and you kind of dreaded going to the circus. I thought that was just very funny. That you would be
really
drawn
thought,
to that
story.
I
want to spend a year with the circus? And, you know, I wasn't so sure. But in researching this book, I gained great respect for circus art, both the circus as they stage it as a whole, as well as the aerialist acts. And I really discovered that these were not circus stories. These were human stories that I was writing about.
Right, right. And I had also heard that your sort of urgency to writing in the wake of being trained as a lawyer came after 9/11. And maybe you can talk about that. But I also am interested in the renewed urgency of stories like this. I mean, I feel like, you know, a year ago, 2 years ago, stories of the Holocaust and the reminder, you know, never forget, felt sort of, I mean, I hate to use the word quaint, but it felt sort of like, well, obvious, you know, of course we won't forget. And suddenly now, as the book is being born into the world, you know, there's a real risk again and a renewed sense of urgency, much like that 9/11 sense of urgency.
That's an interesting parallel. I mean, with respect to sort of current events, I think there's actually been a resurgence in World War II and Holocaust literature over the past several years, owing to factors like the survivors getting up there in years. But what you're talking about is the more immediate need to think about things in light of current world events.
Right.
And I will say when I started this book 2 or 3 years ago, I certainly could not have envisioned where we find ourselves now. But it's such a timely topic for themes of refuge and sanctuary and our individual moral responsibility to people around us.
Exactly. Exactly right. Yeah, I always think it's interesting what a book is born into, what world a book is born into, and it strikes me that this is a good book for this time.
Thank you. And you asked also about sort of my own personal epiphany and with as a writer, and just to, you know, mention that briefly, what had happened is I was a kid who always wanted to be a writer, always wanted to be a novelist. But for so many years, I never got started. And then I finished diplomacy. I went to law school, and I began practicing law on September 4th, 2001, which was exactly 1 week before 9/11 happened. And in that moment, I just had a life epiphany where I said, you know, if I had been a 9/11 victim, I never would have become a novelist. I never would have realized my dream, and I did not have forever to do this. So I became serious about writing as a result of 9/11. The catch, of course, was that I was still a new attorney at a big firm with a lot of student loan debt to repay. And so I had to write my novels around the edges, you know, from 5 to 7 in the morning or something like that.
Right, right. It's so funny to me how many lawyers become novelists. I was a lawyer back in the day, and just how many people I think really want to be writers, and they're looking to the law to, you know, as a way to still express themselves through language and through words, but also pay the bills. I don't know.
I do think that, you know, although I'm not practicing law presently, I teach law school, and I think there's a wonderful synergy between law and writing. So my writing side can really help me inform my students about writing processes and how to get started and knowing yourself as a writer. and storytelling, of course. But my lawyer side is actually very useful as a writer, because one of the things you really learn as a lawyer is how to revise, you know, how to take feedback and incorporate it into a document. And that's very valuable as a writer.
That's interesting. And discipline, I think, is obviously key in your world. I can't believe that you've written this many novels while doing, and I know you have young
children. I'm getting slower with age, but I think you're right about the discipline. You know, I always say I don't believe in writer's block, because when I was a lawyer, I couldn't just say, oh, I'm not inspired to write a brief this week. You know, I would have lost my job. And so if you try and take that same, I don't want to say business alike, but a very disciplined approach with writing, it definitely helps.
Exactly right. Exactly right. You're tuned into Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest this morning is Pam Jenoff. We have one copy of her book available for your $50 donation. And we encourage you to call in 949-824-5824. This is your one time a year that you get to give us a call and show us that the show is meant a lot to you, that the station is meant a lot to you, that independent public radio, commercial free radio means a lot to you. Especially in these times when commercial free radio is in a little bit of peril, it's a good time to show support. If ever there was a good time, this is a good time. I also wanted to talk about the incredible amount of research, I'm guessing, went into this. I know that you spent some time in Poland some time back. But talk a little bit about the research that went into this, how much you knew before writing the book, or if you kind of researched as you went along, and what that process looked like.
So the question of historical research is interesting. Last year I was on a panel with two writers who write more modern fiction, and one of them said, well, I just sort of turn on the computer and start writing. And I did this double take. I was like, really? Because that's not how it works with historical fiction. There's a whole other job there with the research. And I like to say that there's three questions about research: how to do the research, how to incorporate the research, and how not to screw up the research. Those are kind of the big three. But specifically with respect to doing the research, The Orphan's Tale, you know, I have a really strong grounding in World War II. I lived in Europe for almost 5 years, so I have a real background. But there was lots I didn't know for The Orphan's Tale. It's largely set in France, which is not my comfort zone, learning about the circus and learning about flying trapeze and all of those things. So I had a lot of resources, books, correspondence, photographs, maps, periodicals from the time period, some film, you know, all of those types of things can be useful resources. And I had an aerialist on retainer, and by that I mean she was helping me for free. But she would answer my questions once I finally had them about how the you know, physical logistics of and mechanics of flying trapeze would work. So those were the kinds of things that I guess I used for this book in particular.
You'd said something about how a circus arts in, I don't know if it's European circus arts or circus arts during the 1940s differed so much from American circus arts. And I wondered if you could describe that a little.
Sure. Well, there is a difference. I mean, there are just differences. First of all, the circuses over there were always one ring. The terminology is very different. The roles the animals played was very different. So one question I had when I started this book was like, well, should I go to the circus? And then, you know, I didn't really want to. And ultimately, I thought going to a U.S. circus would have been almost misleading for me. So I was really trying to find all the material I could about the European circus arts. And although there's some things that have been written in the U.S. that were also very helpful. And also another question you asked, which I don't think I really touched on, was I'm sort of a contemporaneous researcher, so I only need so much research before I start writing. And then I just go, you know, as I'm writing for what I need.
And how much that kind of leads into the question of structuring the novel, and how much of the story was kind of contained in your head before it was formed on the page, how much you knew of it, and kind of how you structured the book. Did you do it as you were going along, or did you kind of have a sense of it before you started?
Well, as you probably know, they say there's two types of writers, plotters and pantsers. So plotters are those dear souls that write in a linear fashion and make every sentence look nice before they go on, and they probably have an outline. I'm not one of those. I'm a pantser. So that means when I have an idea for a book, I turn on a computer and I go blah for like 3 or 4 months and just 60,000 of the worst words imaginable come out in any order for me. And then when it gets unwieldy, then I start with the chapters and the outlines. This is the worst way to write a book. The editing is terrible, and I don't recommend it, but it's the only way I can do it. So I generally have, like, an opening image and a vague idea of where we might wind up, but the middle is very much in question. And with this book, I knew pretty early on that there would be these two different women, both with their own point of view. The natural inclination would have been to alternate every other chapter for symmetry, you know, Noah, Astrid. But I found that at some point, one of them just needed more space to tell the story. So rather than perfect symmetry, I've gone for balance in how the point of view shake out.
Exactly, right. And let's talk about Noah and Astrid and mining these characters. I think women's relationships with each other are endlessly fascinating in real life and in literature, and getting those just right and getting the nuances that women have with each other just right. So maybe we can talk a little bit about these women, who may have given you more trouble, who was more difficult to access, kind of your process of getting to know them, if you kind of kept notebooks about them. I hear some writers keep scrapbooks about their characters to get a sense of what they look like and what they wore. Just talk about your process of getting to know these two.
Well, I'm not one that does sort of character sketches or interviews ahead of time. Because I do write in this sort of nonlinear way, for me it's more akin to a fossil dig where you have something unearthed and then you're dusting it off to see what it looks like, you know, underneath is how I would view it. So it kind of happens through the writing. I do have a notebook, but the actual getting to know the characters comes about for me through the writing. So, you know, it's interesting. People always ask me, do I have a favorite between two? And not really. I mean, Noah's very young, so that's different. Astrid, there's a lot of true history in Astrid. So she's this aerialist, and she's about 39 or 40. She was from a Jewish circus dynasty of her own family, and that is true history. I was amazed to discover centuries of Jewish circus dynasties in Europe that were largely wiped out by the end of the war. So I loved breathing life into that story with Astrid. Astrid left her circus family to go marry a German officer, and then he was ordered to divorce her. And that's also a bit of true history, where the German soldiers were sent home to divorce their Jewish wives. And so there's a real circus performer, Irene Danner, who was my inspiration for Astrid. And then about a month ago, I received an email from Irene Danner's niece, who had taken care of her till her death, saying she had heard about the book and thanking me. And that was really incredible.
Oh, that's amazing. Too bad you didn't know her before you were writing.
That's what I thought, right? I would love to have talked to her beforehand.
Yeah, what a resource. That's incredible. I always think that these serendipitous things that happen to writers, either as they're writing or through the publishing process, just they're like gifts from the universe to say, you know what, you're on the right track. You did the right thing. And you know, I mean, writers need as much validation as we can get, I think. And that's, isn't that great when that happens? I love it.
It was a key part of my very first book as well, meeting Holocaust survivors. And they told me an incredible story of the Krakow resistance, which I'd never known after years of living in Krakow. So, yes, those moments are very rare and special.
That's really great. What surprised you the most when you were writing this? Did your characters behave themselves, or did they kind of go off the rails and take you into directions you didn't anticipate? Or was there something about the writing process of it that kind of surprised you or that you learned along the way?
Well, you know, because I don't have such a set out plan, it's not that they really go off the rails, because I don't necessarily have rails, you know. So that wasn't necessarily the case. I was very gratified by how much I came to admire and appreciate the circus. I had not expected that. And also, you know, I call this the book that it broke me to write. And that really goes back to those babies on the train, because I knew as soon as I read that bit of history that it was going to go into my book and it was going to figure prominently in my book and all of that. But I waited forever to write that scene. I felt as though to do it justice, I would have to metaphorically put my own three small children on that train. And so the process of writing that and dealing with the kind of the traumatic stress afterwards was really transformative.
I'd like to give sort of space and time to the importance of literature for that very reason, and it being such an act of empathy for both the writer and the reader to put themselves in a space in other people's lives that they otherwise wouldn't inhabit. And what an important thing, especially in today's world, and all that's happening in it, is for us to make that leap, to put ourselves into somebody else's shoes, you know, to live inside that train car with all those babies being sent off to concentration camps, that if you really, and if the reader will really put themselves and their own children in that train car, what a powerful act that is, and what repercussions that could have for kind of how we live our lives and how we see what's going on in the world. I think that's so powerful.
Thank you.
I wonder if you had any, or if you felt any trepidation about writing about the Holocaust, because we have, you know, so as you mentioned earlier, so much literature out there and so many books coming out about it. Does that give you pause, or would you tell other writers, you know, oh, that's, or did you hear from your publisher, oh, that's been so written about, and overcoming that impulse to say, oh, that's been so written about, to find new ways into stories that have been told, but you found such a new door in and such an original way to tell it. But I'm worried some writers might be a little bit scared to take on a topic that they feel like has been done.
Well, you know, so I've been writing about the Holocaust and World War II for about a decade, a little more. My first novel, The Commandant's Girl, came out 10 years ago. And so I think there's two questions I wrestle with. One is the originality question that you've mentioned. And from that, I remember the very first agent I ever approached saying, well, how is this different than all those other World War II novels? So I've always faced that question. And I do think that the stories are there and they are fresh. If you look for them, it really comes down to the gray areas in people. You know, what happened during the war was just not as black and white as what I learned in history class. And so I like to explore the tough questions in people and their choices. The other question, though, about the other daunting question, writing about the Holocaust and World War II, is there's sort of this huge responsibility when you take it on to do it respectfully and to get it right. And I remember, you know, at times I've been paralyzed. I remember when I was writing my first book, seeing Band of Brothers, which is just the most amazing thing ever put on film. And when they liberate the camp, it's so well done. And I remember saying, who am I to be writing dinner parties in Krakow when this was going on 50 kilometers away? And the answer was, well, because there really were dinner parties and there really were these other things. And so there's so many facets to show of the war. But I always take it on with a lot of trepidation. And I consider my books love songs to the people who lived through that most difficult of eras. So that's what I'm trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree. I mean, they say every story has been told many times, and it's the way, you know, but you could set out to say the same story. And I think if you put 10 authors on the case, you'd come up with 10 very different books, all, you know, potentially beautiful and rich. And it is an endlessly interesting question to me.
KCR?
We are drawing down on our time, but I'd love for you to leave us with any advice that you feel like is helpful to writers, what you tell aspiring writers, what you've told yourself to keep yourself going through all of these books while holding down a job, while holding down three kids, something to sustain us in the dark hours.
Well, I would just say, you know, be disciplined, because even now nobody gives me writing time. You have to carve it out and protect it. And to be tenacious, because I went through 5 years and 39 publisher rejections before anyone ever picked up my first book. And frankly, I know better writers who aren't published, but it was just a question of continuing to try.
Yeah, good advice. This was originally called The Aerialist, I heard somewhere.
It was. My books always change covers and titles, and I've learned not to get too attached.
Well, it is lovely. It's a lovely novel. Pam Jenoff, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again. That was Pam Jenoff. The book is The Orphan's Tale. It is out and available. It's published by Mira Books, and it's available to you for your $50 donation. We will send one out to you. Just to reiterate, our phones are a little bit quiet, and we love to hear from our listeners. We love to hear from people who have been tuning into this station, you know, within the just one show or two, or for the entire past 20 years that we've been on the air. Barbara Nicole and I have donated our time. I actually donated my own $100 this morning. So we do this as an act of love. I have been enriched so much by the station over the last 10 years that I've been here. It's brought so much joy to my life. And I view KUCI as kind of my own personal family at this point. You know, we've interviewed, I don't know at this point, thousands of authors, but I personally have interviewed hundreds of amazing writers, gotten some amazing advice over the years, and have heard their stories, all the varied, rich ways they came to writing and have benefited from their advice, benefited from their craft talks. And if that has served you over the years, we would love to hear from you, and we just love to hear your stories. So 949-824-5824, 949-UCI-KUCI, or you can give online and at KUCI.org. And again, we have some very, very cool premiums to offer. We have some gift certificates to local bookstores. We have some books to give out. We have t-shirts and tickets and concert tickets and records and CDs, all kinds of things. So whatever appeals to you, whatever little swag you'd like to take home to say that you are a great supporter of public radio, we would love to offer it to you. And obviously, your gift is tax deductible. So, you know, it's only like giving half or something of what you'd normally be giving. So anyway, give us a call. I'm going to be here for the rest of the hour. These gift certificates and books are only available during the hour I'm here. They go away as soon as I go off the air. So give us a call if you want to grab those before I take off today at 10. Again, 949-824-5824. I'm going to take a very short break, but please stay with me. Eric Punchner will be joining for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, and we'll be right back. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at KUCI.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. Or you can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com. So in case you haven't heard, it is Fund Drive Week. Actually, it's Fund Drive 10 days at KUCI, or maybe 2 weeks. And so we are here this week taking your calls and hopefully taking your money, but really taking your calls. We love it to hear from listeners at this time of year because it's your one time every year that you can give back, that you can show us that you appreciate the station, that you appreciate public commercial free radio, that you appreciate independent radio and all that we do. 20 years almost this show has been on the air, and the radio station has been going since 1969. 24/7 of commercial free public radio coming straight to your iPhone, straight to your computer, straight to your radio. So anyway, we would love to hear from you. 949-824-5824, 949-UCI-KUCI, or you can donate online at KUCI.org. And we are lucky enough to be giving out free copies of both authors' books this morning for your $50 donation. Eric Punchner is on with me now. We have, I love his short story collection. You know what a crazy person I am for short story collections, and this is coming soaring to the top of my list. So if you too are a lover of the short story or a lover of literary fiction in general, you will not want to miss getting your hands on a copy of this, and you could do that today for the next, I don't know, 25 minutes with your $50 donation. So give us a call. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Eric Punchner is the author and is the author of the collection Music Through the Floor, a finalist for the New York Public Library's Young Lions Fiction Award, and the novel Model Home, a finalist for the Penn Faulkner Award and Barnes & Noble Discover Award, and winner of the California Book Award. He's received a Pushcart, an NEA Fellowship, an award in literature from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. His work has appeared all over the place, but most notably in Best American Non-Required Reading, Best American Short Stories, Tin House, Granta, Zoetrope. He's a professor at the Writing Seminar at Johns Hopkins. Last Day on Earth is this new collection. It is incredible. It is published by Scribner, We have one copy to give away today. I would call quickly. It is fantastic. Eric, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, I'm very happy to have you on. This was just so wonderful. So you've been writing short stories for a long time, and I'd just love for you to take us into this collection, kind of the themes and thoughts and ideas that were plaguing you when you wrote these 9 stories, and kind of take us into this world.
Yeah, I have been. I mean, the short story was always kind of my first love ever since I was a boy. I just loved the form so much. So I was really happy to return to it after I wrote my novel. I'm not one of those short story writers who write story cycles where every story is somehow sort of in direct dialogue with the next, and there aren't sort of recurring characters or anything like that. I mean, one of the things that I love about the short story is that it's this kind of profoundly weird American art form, and I love the chance to sort of start afresh every few months and write a new story and do something completely different, and sometimes even sort of dare myself to try something that I haven't tried before. So I'm sort of hesitant to say that there's any kind of unifying theme to the stories, except that they were things that I was very excited about writing and trying at the time.
There's a lot of young folks in here. I mean, some of them kind of feel coming of age, even when the narrators aren't, you know, technically teenagers. Mm-hmm. They still feel like they're kind of struggling to find their way in the world. And, you know, no matter what age they are, they still feel like they're kind of coming of age.
Yeah, that's definitely true, and it's something that I'm really drawn to. I've thought a lot about this because people have mentioned the fact that there are a number of sort of coming-of-age stories about young boys in particular, or teenage boys, and it's not something that I actually consciously try to do in the collection, but I am really drawn to that sort of age when boys are still trying to figure out this kind of strange new body that they have found themselves in, that they're sort of inheriting because of puberty. And there's something just inherently and quite suddenly strange about the world when you're a boy at that age. And so a number of the stories sort of deal with that. And then on the other end of the spectrum are some stories that deal with sort of older people who are reckoning with their body's betrayal for the first time. So I guess I am interested in sort of being at odds with one's body and what that might do to you psychologically.
Yeah. I can tell you from personal experience, it's just as jarring as a girl at adolescence.
I'm sure it's probably even more so, I imagine.
It's interesting to me. I've asked this question of short story writers before because I'm endlessly trying to figure out how to do it right, if there is such a thing. But some of the more compelling stories in here feel like they take sort of a few strands, a few braids that get braided together. I'm thinking, I mean, right now popping into my head is the first story with the cicadas. There are these pervasive cicadas that are kind of invading this town, which is kind of one thread that runs through the story against a lot of other things, against a boy kind of also coming of age, against kind of confronting sexuality, against, I don't know, all kinds of stuff. But it feels like you have these separate strands that then get kind of woven together, each feeding the other, even though they're kind of independent storylines. Is that kind of a conscious device or tool that you use when you're putting short stories together to find some symbol or image and then weave it throughout the story to heighten the action or the suspense or the psychological intrigue?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, for me, short stories are all about, well, first of all, they're all about kind of reversals, right? So you have a situation at the beginning that is somehow reversed or changed by the end. That doesn't necessarily mean that the character has to change, but it could mean that the reader's relationship to the story changes, or his or her perception of the story changes. But to get at that change, you need to achieve a kind of singleness of effect, and that's one thing that I'm really drawn to in the short story is that, you know, Louis Menand in the New Yorker once called it the "woe" effect that only a short story really has. It's that moment in a short story where the hairs on the back of your neck kind of stand up, and it has that kind of uncanniness that I think is built into the DNA of the short story in particular. I mean, if you look at the history of the short story and the first short stories ever written, you know, the stories of Hawthorne or Poe, they're sort of literally uncanny. I mean, they're sometimes about ghosts. But I think that even, you know, since Chekhov and since, you know, stories have begun, in some cases have become more realistic, we've still, the short story still carries that DNA in it and that kind of essential weirdness and uncanniness. And so, for me, a short story is really about creating these various, I don't know if you want to call them subplots or threads or motifs, that come together in a really surprising and unexpected way near the end. So in the story that you're talking about, which is called Brood X, it's about this cicada invasion in Baltimore, and this young boy is privy to. It begins with the sentence, "It was the summer of the cicadas," and I was really drawn to that image in particular because of what it did to the world around the protagonist, which is suddenly turn it from this world that he recognized into a world that he no longer recognized, that seemed strange and new to him. And that was also kind of what his body was doing to him, and his, you know, his first feelings of kind of a sexual awakening were doing to him as well. And so that's a way in which sort of the setting itself is mirroring the psychological experience of the character. And I don't want to give too much away, but yeah. The story develops in such a way that those two things sort of become closer and closer in alignment until we reach that kind of whoa moment, I hope, that I've been talking about at the end.
So great. It's interesting, when I was doing some research on the book, I came across this website that I've never seen before called Great Writers Steal. And they took one at, hopefully you know about this because you're on it.
I did not know about
it. It's a really cool website. So it's called greatwritersteal.com. And you should check it out because they've totally digested Beautiful Monsters, the second story in your collection on there. But what they do is they dissect a short story and then they take away from it the greatest things about it and ideas that they can steal when they want to write their own short stories. And something you just touched on was in Brood X, they also touched on in Beautiful Monsters, which is establishing a strangeness of your unique world clearly and early, and then putting your characters on some sort of countdown, which is obviously done in Beautiful Monsters really nicely.
Oh yeah, thank you. That's an unusual story, and it's a sort of story that I've never really tried to write before. I guess you could call it science fiction. It's not really a genre that I traffic in very often. I will say though that one of the first books that I ever read that really blew me away was Ray Bradbury's collected stories. I think that my brother, I was quite young at the time, I think it was maybe 8, and my brother had gotten it for Christmas, and I'm not sure he even touched it, but I read the thing cover to cover. It was over 1,000 pages, I think, and I really loved it, and it was also the first time that I started to think about authorship in general. I mean, I had just sort of imagined, I think, as we often do as kids, that books just kind of write themselves or the words just kind of fall out of the sky and are perfectly inevitable, you know. But I read this, and that was back in the when they used to use those enormous author's photos on the back covers of books that would take up the entire back cover. And so there was this giant picture of Ray Bradbury on the back, and that was the first time I thought, wow, somebody actually wrote all these words and constructed these beautiful stories that had this kind of profound impact on me. And I started to think about, yeah, maybe I want to do something like that someday. What a cool job that would be. So he was one of my early influences, and I think in some ways Beautiful Monsters is kind of an homage to Bradbury.
It's interesting you bring him up because one of the other things that really struck me about your writing in general you just have endless perfect phrases that I copy down and just want to replicate. One thing you do that I think is really interesting is you turn nouns into verbs to describe whatever, like you've got, you know, frozen sausage furred with ice, or, you know, the air had been gauzed with smoke. Just these really interesting ways of describing objects, taking a noun and turning it into a verb. And Bradbury does something, I feel like Bradbury does something similar to that, not the same thing, but the way you both, your lens on the world, I would say, is very reminiscent. It's just lovely. I don't know how you do that.
Thank you. I mean, one of the things that I think I took from Bradbury is just the desire to defamiliarize the world, which is really why I love fiction so much, but short stories in particular. It seems to be that's what short stories are all about, to take something that we see every day and maybe have forgotten to notice and describe it or articulate it in a way that brings it alive again. And makes it fresh and original. And so I sometimes have students who come to my office and they, this is always makes my sort of stomach drop, but they'll ask me, you know, am I talented? Do I have what it takes to become a writer? And my first response is always to ask them, well, do you like sentences? And sometimes they are completely nonplussed by that question, and I know that maybe they don't have it what it takes, because really that's what writing is all about, is writing sentences, and that's most of the enjoyment I get out of writing stories, and my novel was just writing that sentence, then the next sentence, the next sentence, and trying to make that the best possible, most original, freshest sentence I could without overdoing those sentences and making them too eccentric, so...
That might answer my.
Thank you.
That might answer my question about whether these things come about in the revision process or whether they come about as you're writing the story itself. It sounds like they come about as you're writing the story itself.
Well, both, definitely. You know, I know people who say, like, who talk about writing their first drafts incredibly quickly, and they advise young writers to do that. Just get everything, you know, just sort of vomit it onto the page, get it out as quickly as you possibly can, and. You know, I often tell students to write more slowly, frankly, because they're not paying enough attention to the way that each of their sentence sounds. That doesn't mean you should write cripplingly slow, but I do think that paying attention to the way that each of your sentences sounds and trying to make it as good as you possibly can before going on to the next one, it's harder to go back, I think, after you've written something and make your sentences have that sort of essential quality. I think it's easier to do it when you're first writing a sentence and you're still excited about it.
Right.
So, but absolutely, I mean, when I go back and I rewrote some of these stories, you know, maybe 10, 11 times more possibly, and a couple of the stories, I think I stuck away in my drawer for a couple of years. I just let them sit there before returning to them. And, of course, always when I return to them, I comb through the sentences again and make sure they're as, you know, perfect as I can possibly make them.
Yeah. Well, you did it. You did it. My guest this morning is Eric Buchner. The book is Last Day on Earth. We have a copy of it to give away for your $50 donation for the next 13 minutes. If you call in 949-824-5824, 949-UCI-KUCI. We are in fund drive mode, and we are matching your donations up to $100 for the next 12 minutes. So give us a call. We'd love to hear from our loyal listeners. One thing that I've been doing lately that I think is fun with short story writers, perhaps you won't think it's fun, but maybe you will, is having you choose a story from the collection, whichever one kind of makes the most sense to you, and we can kind of deconstruct it on the air and talk about the original kernel of the idea for that story, how it evolved, how maybe it surprised you in its evolutions. And, you know, you can just kind of talk about finding the imagery for it, finding the metaphors for it, revising it, whatever occurs to you. And, you know, it doesn't have to be your favorite short story. Maybe it's the one you struggled with the most, whatever kind of makes sense to you.
Sure. Wow, that's an interesting question and a big one.
I know, right?
Let's see. Well, there's a story called Mothership, which took me a long time to write. It's a story about a psychotically depressed woman. And I guess I'm choosing it right now because I'm thinking about its genesis, and it was kind of a complicated genesis, so it might be interesting to talk about. It's what happens in the story is that there's the protagonist is named Jess. She's just gotten out of a treatment center because she's tried to kill herself, and she comes to help take care of her niece and nephew. Her sister lives in L.A. She's come to L.A. to help try to take care of them because her brother-in-law is in the hospital, and so her sister needs the help, needs the kind of babysitting help. And so she goes out with the kids on Halloween and is supposed to be supervising them while they trick-or-treat, and something very strange happens. And before I tell you what that strange thing is, I'll back up a little bit and tell you where the story partly came from, which was that I mean, I'm often inspired by other writers and other books and other stories that I've read, and one of my favorite stories in the world is The Kiss by Chekhov. Mm. And in that story, it's about an officer in the Russian brigade, and he is this kind of very timid, shy, awkward, probably somewhere on the spectrum we would describe him as being now. And he goes to a party at another officer's house and has this kind of very strange encounter at the party where he goes back, and I think he's looking for the bathroom or something, but he goes into the back of the house and ends up in this kind of semi-dark room, and this woman pops out of nowhere, mistaking him for somebody else because it's dark, and throws her arms around him and kisses him. And then, of course, realizes she's made a mistake and shrieks and runs out. But the kiss has this kind of profound transformation on the protagonist. And I loved the fact that there is that case of mistaken identity in that story. And so I wanted to kind of contemporize it and make it into something new and fresh. And so when Jess is out trick-or-treating, she's wearing an alien mask, so you can't see her face, and she's walking around with her sister's kids, and so she has grown up kind of worshiping her sister because she's beautiful and has always been kind of effortlessly popular, and she at least perceives that her sister has this effortlessly happy existence in L.A. with her loving husband, but when she's out trick-or-treating with her sister's kids, a neighbor mistakes her for her sister and comes down and ends up kind of sexually accosting her because he thinks that she is her sister, and they're actually having an affair. So there was that kind of electric moment in the story, and that was where it came from. But in the first draft of the story kind of ended at that moment. It actually ended sort of in the next scene. That was the penultimate scene, and then the next scene she sees her sister and kind of reckons with the fact that she doesn't know everything about her sister's life, and her sister isn't as perfectly happy as she had imagined. But it just felt like it wasn't quite surprising enough it wasn't exhausting the dramatic potential of the story or the story's themes. And so I actually decided, I put the story away for a long time, and then I came back to it, and I figured out, like, well, what would this protagonist do if she really wanted to be her sister so badly? Well, she might actually become her sister in some way. And so I wrote a scene in which she puts on the mask that she was wearing earlier and goes out in the middle of the night and goes over to the man who her sister's having an affair with's house, and they have a sexual encounter while he thinks that she's her sister, which is, it sounds incredibly preposterous when I'm talking about it now, but of course stories are all about making the implausible as plausible as you can. Mm-hmm. And so that took the story to a whole new place and felt very surprising and unexpected. It had that thing that Flannery O'Connor talks about, which is that inevitable surprise in a story that you want, that you want as a writer and, of course, as a reader.
Yes, yes. It's so heartbreaking. That story's so heartbreaking. It's just... so that's interesting. So you initially wrote it, and then it sat for how long? You said you put it away for a couple of years.
I'm trying to remember. At least a year, mm-hmm. probably longer. I wrote it, and I have this workshop that I do online with, we sort of FaceTime with some friends of mine, who I know from Stanford, and they workshopped it. They liked it, but I wasn't completely happy with it, so I put it away for a while, as I often do, and then came back to it, and that's when I had that sort of idea of where the story could go from there.
I think that raises an interesting question about short story writers knowing when something is done, and knowing, even if it isn't done, when to let it go, and when, maybe either to abandon it or to try and publish it or to try and, say, okay, I need a year's break. Is that all just instinct, or are there guidelines that you follow where you're like, I just have to let this one go. It's not going to, it doesn't have legs or, you know, or I just need to.
Yeah, I mean, I wish there was some kind of formula or algorithm.
Right?
You know, it's very difficult. There's no real answer to that. There are a couple of stories that I wrote for this collection. I don't think my publisher even knows this, that I just, that I scrapped after I'd sent them through a couple drafts because they just never, they were fine. You know, they just never sort of excited me. It's kind of a sort of just an emotional response that I have to a story where I feel continually excited. Of course, sometimes I hate them, but I eventually come back to being very interested in them again. You know, no, so you can never make a story perfect, so you have to find that kind of sweet spot where you've made it as perfect as you can possibly make it. It's always going to have flaws. Basically, you still like the story, but you can't stand to look at it anymore, honestly.
Yeah, right.
And you just feel like if I keep the story on my desk any longer, I'm going to go insane.
Right.
And that's sort of when you send it out. But you can't send it out too early. If you can't make the story as good as you possibly can make it, then there's really no reason to write it in the first place.
Yeah. And I think if it still interests you after a year, there's something really there. I mean, you know, if it stands the test of time of you coming back to it and still being interested in what it's talking about, I think that's probably a good indication that you're on the right track.
Definitely. That's the real answer. Yeah. I mean, you have to sort of give it time and see if it still stands up.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
We're out of time, but 30 seconds of advice that we haven't shared yet. If there's none, it's okay.
30 seconds of advice. Wow. To who? To young writers?
Yeah, to young writers. Right. Right.
The young writers.
Or even old writers like me.
You know, the most important thing, I think, is doggedness, you know, even more than talent in some cases. You know, the people that I saw who were young writers who ended up making it weren't necessarily the most brilliantly talented who I went to grad school with, but the ones who just kept at it and kept at it and kept at it and steeled themselves to rejection, you know, that's what writing is about, is doggedness.
So true. That's so true. Eric Pookmeyer, thank you so much. This was a huge pleasure.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thanks again. That was Eric Pookmeyer. The book is The Last Day on Earth. It's available for exactly 4 minutes, or your Last Day on Earth is going to be up. So anyway, give us a call. It's 949-824-5824, even if you don't make it during the show, and you'll miss out on great books and great gift certificates, but that's okay. We are here for the next, through next week. And Barbara will be here next week doing the same thing I'm doing this week, which is talking with great authors and taking your donations. And even if you just want to give us a call and say that you appreciate what we do here on the air and, you know, give 10 bucks or 35 bucks or whatever you have, that's great. You know, if you want to give us your Starbucks donation for the day, that's fantastic too. We just love hearing from you, and we love hearing that this show matters, that amazing writers like Eric and Pam, who shared their wisdom this morning, who shared their kind of life's work with us this morning and all of their tips and tricks that help you will mean something in your life, and that you can, you know, give back and show that that matters. So we are taking donations online, KUCI.org, or we are taking them over the phone, 949-824-5824. That's all the time I have for today, but Barbara will be here with you next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Stay tuned for Kaleidoscope Days, which is some indie music, techno music, coming up next with DJ Lyle. And we will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great, great day.